And the Peter B. Collins Show rolls on. We're sponsored by Cinema Classics, the movie company specializing in classic Hollywood and foreign films. Check out their 30% off sale and their great collection of old movies on DVD and VHS. Just click on the link at peterbcollins.com. We'll get you free shipping, too, on any order. Just enter PBC in the comments section of the order form, and the shipping is on them. In talking with Asim Qureshi and Andy Worthington, I mentioned that Worthington is really the worldwide leader in terms of journalists who pay attention to the issues of Guantanamo Bay, Cuba. He's done exhaustive coverage, and I give him great credit for that. On these shores, one of his collaborators is Jason Leopold. He is the deputy managing editor at truthout.org. And Jason has taken a strong interest in some of the issues related to our detention and torture policies. And he just published here on December 1st a new article that he investigated with Jeffrey Kay, who is a psychologist who's been on our program in the past, regarding the use of drugs on inmates, prisoners, held at Guantanamo and elsewhere. And previously, Jason and Jeffrey published articles detailing how there were experiments. Yes, human experiments using drugs and using the torture techniques that were conducted by our government on some of the early people taken into custody. And it resulted, for example, in a bizarre shift in the waterboarding protocols to prevent the subject from catching pneumonia. And that's just one example. There's a new story out, and it's very important and very powerful. Jason Leopold, welcome back to our program.
Thanks for having me on the show, Peter.
Good to be back. Always good to talk with you, and you were just here the other day, and I appreciate your contributions on so many different issues. Tell us a little bit, let me do this. Let me summarize this by reading the first couple of paragraphs of your article,
right,
and then I'll ask you some questions. Your lead: the Defense Department forced all War on Terror detainees at the Guantanamo Bay prison to take a high dose of a controversial anti-malarial drug called mefloquine, or mefloquine. You describe that as an act that an Army public health physician called pharmacologic waterboarding. The story goes on. The U.S. military administered the drug despite Pentagon knowledge that mefloquine, you'll help me pronounce that, caused severe neuropsychiatric side effects, including suicidal thoughts, hallucinations, and anxiety. The drug was used on the prisoners whether they had malaria or not. And this revelation, which has not been previously reported, was buried in documents that were released by the Defense Department 2 years ago as part of the government's investigation into the deaths in 2006 of three detainees at Guantanamo Bay. And that's the story that Scott Horton has detailed on this program and in Harper's Magazine. And it's another black mark on the Obama administration because they have decided not to further investigate those three very questionable deaths. So, Jason, first of all, help me pronounce the name of this drug.
Sure. It's mefloquine. Mefloquine. It's M-E-F-L-O-Q-U-I-N-E. A very, very powerful anti-malarial drug. And given at treatment-level doses to all Guantanamo detainees, to all detainees who were transferred to Guantanamo, it was actually one of the first, thing that they were, or medication that they were given as far as the standard in processing order form states.
Mm-hmm.
And it was done before any laboratory test, before doing any sort of test to determine if there was, you know, if there was any threat. And you know, experts in, you know, tropical diseases have said this is just unprecedented. This amounted to mass presumptive treatment of a small population, if you will. And you know, Jeff Kay and I have spent the past year really looking into the issue of drugs used on detainees for a wide range of reasons. And while we don't suggest in this story that there was that this was definitively used to torture detainees, because we don't have the evidence, what we do say is that it's pretty much clinically indefensible, that there's no medical justification for doing this. It's unprecedented.
Mm-hmm.
And Army Specialist Joe Hickman, who actually is credited with first bringing forward evidence that the three Guantanamo detainees who the government says committed suicide in June 2006, Joe had brought forth evidence that actually showed that it was they could not have died by hanging themselves.
Right.
And he was the one who...
he was on the guard tower that night, right?
Right. And he's the one who actually brought that over to Scott Horton,
mm-hmm.
over to Harper's. And he had read some of the work that I have been doing along with Jeff on this issue, and he spent he's still investigating the death of those detainees, and has been going through all the documents and pointed out the standard in processing order form order sheet for detainees, and pointed out this drug. And so Jeff and I then spent the past 2 months looking into it. And, sure enough, this drug has a very dark history. It comes from a family of drugs that called quinolines. And I may be mangling that a bit, but it was which were used as part of the CIA's mind control MK Ultra experiment. Human experimentation program.
And let me just complete a circle here, because
sure.
It was you who introduced me to Dr. Jeff Kay, and then it was Jeff Kay who introduced me to Hank Alberelli, and both are contributors to Truth Out. Alberelli wrote the book about the Frank Olson murder called A Terrible Mistake, and it is an 800-page detailed chronicle of the LSD and other drugs that were used on an experimental basis as weapons by our government starting after World War II and continuing well into the 1960s. And so this is part of a larger pattern that we have to acknowledge, that our government has been using bioweapons and has at least been developing them and preparing them for military deployment since the end of World War II. And at times we've kind of cleaned up our act and said we're not going to do this anymore and we're shutting down the labs. But Fort Detrick is the site where much of this research was and is being conducted.
Right.
And just today I got a detailed story taking apart the FBI investigation into the death of Dr. Bruce Ivins at Fort. He was there at Fort Detrick, and after he died, he was fingered as the source of the anthrax that was mailed to Democratic leaders,
right,
and some media people in October of 2011. And so we need to look at this as part of the bigger picture, that we have been, experimenting with these things for a long time.
And absolutely, yes. I mean, this is a, there's a history here. And, obviously we only recently learned about, experiments in Guatemala.
Mm-hmm.
So, that were, sanctioned by the U.S. government. So clearly, this has a very long history, these types of programs.
Mm-hmm.
And, as I said, with mesalequin, first of all, people should understand this. There is no malaria. Malaria does not exist in Cuba. And, in addition, as we demonstrate, in our story, a decade earlier, between 1991 and 1992, there were actually thousands of Haitian refugees who were held at Guantanamo.
Right.
And there was a fear about malaria outbreak, and there were about 235 cases came up with individuals who had malaria, and they before they actually gave this mass presumptive treatment, just literally dosing everyone, they first conducted laboratory tests, and then those who were determined to be infected were given a different drug called chloroquine. And that's a bit safer, so it just shows that the history behind it. We've done things differently, even treating U.S. soldiers coming back from Afghanistan. Not given mass presumptive treatment of a highly controversial drug that, by the way, is known. There's the documentation on this drug is just can go on for miles. There is a history behind it that it causes bizarre dreams, suicidal thoughts, has been linked to suicide, anxiety. Aggression. I mean, it just goes on and on.
I won't go the full mile, but let me quote from your article. Major Remington Nevin, an Army public health physician, is quoted. You say that the use of mefloquine in this manner is at best an egregious malpractice. And you quote him further. The government has exposed detainees, quote, to unacceptably high risks of potentially severe neuropsychiatric side effects, including seizures, intense vertigo, hallucinations, paranoid delusions, aggression, panic, anxiety, severe insomnia, and thoughts of suicide. Now, this, I have to infer, is talking about the drug and doesn't even acknowledge the context, all right, that
right.
If you have this drug in your system when you are, processed in to a facility like Guantanamo, and you may have been tortured before you got there, you're being held indefinitely without charge and with virtually no legal rights whatsoever. And in that context, the side effects of a drug like this could be really pronounced and extremely dangerous to the individuals.
Oh, there's absolutely no question. And, in addition to that, this is a drug that the side effects would be exacerbated, if you will, if you have a history of mental illness. They gave detainees this drug without any regard for their, past medical history. Didn't even, take that into consideration. So, the bottom line would ultimately be is that, yes, at best, Dr. Nevin states that it would be an egregious malpractice. But again, as he notes at the end of the article, it calls for further investigation, because how do you defend this? How can the Defense Department, which attempted to defend this, when there's just literally no history where this was done? And it's very important to point out that while they were giving this drug to detainees, there was actually research being conducted by the Defense Department. Calls for research. There were questions about the drug's severe side effects at the same exact time, Peter. So
was that at Camp Mengele at Guantanamo?
It's certainly, look, Guantanamo has been called, as we demonstrated in our, as Jeff and I actually demonstrated in our previous investigative story, it has been referred to as, quote, a battle lab. And that phrase, those two words, come from the Senate Armed Services Committee report on the treatment of detainees in the custody of the Defense Department. So it has been called a battle lab. And when you start putting all these little pieces together, you know, it's very difficult to, come to the conclusion that there was nothing funny going on. I think that, there's plenty of evidence out there that shows that, the detainees certainly have been tortured, but now we're starting to see things that there were, now we're starting to see evidence that there were, special access programs, possible experimentation. As we said, Paul Wolfowitz issued a directive around this time that allowed a waiver for informed consent to advance a, quote, medical product. Health and Human Services, Secretary of Health and Human Services, was given unprecedented authority by George Bush at the same time to classify information as secret. So ultimately it all comes down to more questions and investigations that are needed in order to find out what was actually happening. I will also note that at the same time that we were doing our investigation, the folks over at Seton Hall University, the law school over there, they too were conducting an investigation into this drug, mefloquine. Mark Denbow, who's the head of the Center of Policy and Research, I believe I have, I may be mistaken on the actual title.
No, you got it. You got it right.
Of the school. Okay, good.
I have it in front of me, and you got it right.
So he was also involved in the investigation of the deaths of the three detainees. They came out with a totally separate report today. And, it turns out that we just happened to have some of the same sources. So a few days ago, found out that, we were both working on the same thing. So we did a bit of collaboration. And they make a very, very strong case that, again, they have spoken to experts as well, and that this could rise to the level of violating the anti-torture statute, particularly dealing with mind-altering substances that leads to a profound change in personality. So even as defined by John Yoo and Jay Bybee in those torture memos. So, again, as Mark Denbow had said, a lot of this could be, or many of the questions that are lingering could be resolved if the government were actually to actually released the medical records of the detainees. And, Jeff and I have actually spent more than a year at this point trying to gain access to those medical records. And it's hilarious, Peter, because, first the government tells us that, the medical records are classified in some cases, protected in others, they will not release them in certain instances due to privacy concerns. For the detainees, even though the detainees have said, please, release the medical records. So we do know that there is documentation. They kept records. Some questions could be answered as a result.
And I want to read a quote from Denbow, but first lift a fact point from earlier in the article. You write that all detainees arriving at Guantanamo in January 2002 were given a dosage of 1,250 milligrams of mefloquine, and that dosage is five times higher than what you would use just to prevent malaria. It's the power dosage that you would use for someone who is actually diagnosed with malaria. So with that in mind, you quote Denbow as saying, a crucial issue is dosage. Giving detainees toxic doses of mefloquine has mind-altering consequences that may be permanent.
Right. Right.
Without access to medical records, which the government refuses to release, the use of mefloquin in this manner appears to be grotesque malpractice at best, if not human experimentation or enhanced interrogation.
Right.
The question is, where are the doctors who approved this practice, and where are the medical records? And this circles back to Jeff Kay, whose original interest in these issues was the extent to which psychologists and medical professionals participated in the torture, the administration of torture, to those who were detained at Guantanamo and elsewhere.
Yes, yeah, exactly, Peter. And I, you know, have to give Jeff, you know, the proper credit. He truly is the person who really helped advance this story. And when I say this story, I mean the issue itself, to the stage that we're at now, that actually got the, you know, helped get the human rights organizations and others looking into this from this perspective. It's you know, he was on this very early on when people were, you know, still dismissing it as conspiracy theory, at least some were. And so, you know, again, it's as you noted, it certainly does smell bad, for lack of a, you know, better description.
Mm-hmm.
And I think that it's just the beginning of many, many stories to come in this particular area. And, you know, we're already finding out that there were, as I noted, special access programs that, you know, dealt with experimentation, you know, to some degree, particularly as it pertains to high-value detainees like Abu Zubaydah. So, you know, there's a lot more work to do. You know, the Pentagon, or the Defense Department, I should say, that, you know, they did respond, and they confirmed it. They confirmed that that mass presumptive treatment was done. Major Tanya Bradshaw, who's a spokeswoman there, she said that, quote, a decision was made. Now, you wouldn't tell us who made that decision, when the decision was made, or why they made that decision. So that's certainly, you know, a question that needs to be answered. The Senate Armed Services Committee was never briefed on this at all, either about the use of mefloquin or any other anti-malarial drug. They were not told of a malaria, you know, problem there. In fact, later on in 2002, September 13th, 2002 to be exact, a letter was sent by the Defense Department to Congressman John McHugh, who's now the Secretary of the Army. In that letter, there was, you know, operational guidelines governing the use of mefloquin. And one thing that was noted in this document is a very short statement, quote, malaria is not a threat at Guantanamo Bay. And as we also noted, there's, you know, we quote from a recent published book by a person named Montgomery Granger, who was a medic over there, and he wrote that there was an epidemiologist, again, mangling some words, who was there for just 2 months and left, and you know, didn't find any insects that were that were disease carrying or a concern, you know, such as mosquitoes, which you know, carry the malaria disease and transfer it. So,
well, I just to help you with the language, I think an entomologist is an expert on insects. And an epidemiologist is an expert on diseases.
Yes.
So I'm not sure which one they sent.
Yeah. Well,
one of those.
Yes. And the one obviously working with insects. And, you know, so by the way, this writing this story, researching this story, has certainly been an education for me.
Uh-huh.
You know, dealing with issues of medicine and psychology and insects, so it's definitely taken on a different sort of life, in a sense. But
and Jason, toward the end of your article, you have a second series of quotes from Major Nevin, the public health specialist in the military. And you say that in 2008, he published a study detailing a high prevalence of mental health contraindications to the safe use of mefloquine in soldiers deployed to Afghanistan, responding in part to concerns raised by the mefloquine-associated suicide of Army Specialist Juan Torres. Internal Army presentations confirmed that the drug had been widely misprescribed to soldiers with contraindications, including many who were on antidepressants.
Right.
A formal policy memo in February 2009 from the Surgeon General of the Army removed mefloquine as a first-line agent and changed the policy so that it would not be prescribed to Army personnel unless they had contraindications to the other preferred drug, the antibiotic doxycycline. Nor could mefloquine be prescribed to any personnel with a history of traumatic brain injury or mental illness. Now, this says that we had a standard to protect our soldiers from
exactly.
the side effects of this drug, and then we administered it on a massive basis to the second-class human beings that we were holding at Guantanamo, and either intentionally exposed them to these side effects or did so in a way that can only be described as callous and inhumane.
Right, yes, and I think that that is... one of the questions that needs to, that begs for answers. And, as I indicated, there was research going on at this, at the same exact time that they were administering this drug to detainees, also calls for research. The drug in September of 2002, that same month that I indicated that there was a letter sent to John McHugh, a former congressman, about DOD's use of mefloquine. Roche, the R-O-C-H-E, the company that markets the drug, which just as a side note, that's the company that Donald Rumsfeld had sold Tamiflu to.
That's right.
And they sent out a letter to physicians and pharmacists, in September 2002, stating that the company was changing its warning labels for mefloquine. And, a couple of the paragraphs that, that they did include, said that mefloquine use included suicidal thoughts and suicide and may cause psychiatric symptoms in a number of patients, ranging from anxiety, paranoia, and depression to hallucination and psychotic behavior. Which have been reported to continue long after mefloquine has been stopped. Again, this is happening at the same time they were giving it to detainees. They were actively researching the drug. There were even calls for by Dianne Feinstein, believe it or not, in 2004, calling on the Pentagon to reassess their use of the drug. So, you start putting it all together, and you come up with a picture of this really doesn't make any sense. Why were they doing this? There was no true medical reason behind it, even though the Defense Department states that it was purely for public health purposes and no other reason. But as the story shows, there's the tropical disease expert said no, there actually isn't. In fact, we quote one who's an advocate of mefloquine use,
mm-hmm.
and even takes it himself when he travels. And he said that it's hard to rationalize the mass presumptive treatment on pure clinical grounds. If they were able to conduct laboratory tests. So the fact that they were able to conduct laboratory tests of this drug, conduct laboratory tests to determine, whether anyone had malaria, really does not make sense as to, at least to him, as to why this drug then would be given before, lab tests done. And at this time, February 2002, January, you know, the Bush administration was actively working on memos to strip detainees of any rights they had under the Geneva Convention.
Yeah.
You know, while there have been claims that detainees gave their informed consent specifically for malarial treatment or malaria treatment, you know, detainees say otherwise. They say that they were forced to take drugs. They were, you know, they could not protest. So, again, you know, lots of questions that you know that have been raised. I don't you know, neither Jeff nor I feel that the, you know, the story sort of shuts the door, if you will, to, you know, what the rationale or reasoning is behind this, but it certainly begs for
A real explanation.
For a real explanation, exactly.
Well, Jason, from your research, tell us what you know about the procedures of processing a new person into Guantanamo, and what kind of documents you have seen and what kind of documents you think exist that they haven't yet disclosed. Because, you know, I'm really curious in terms of, you know, any kind of medical exams or physicals that were conducted to get a baseline on the person's condition, and the extent to which they fudged that information so that after somebody was tortured, you know, it would be less likely that you could prove that it happened after they got to Gitmo, for example.
Yeah. You know, I have to say, Peter, I have not taken a look at some of these documents, and I do have them, particularly the ones where, you know, the in-processing forms for when they're brought in to Guantanamo. So I can't speak authoritatively about that.
All right. Well, but, after you've reviewed them, I'd be curious because I'm interested to see how much documentation there is and just, you know, how incriminating it might be.
Yeah. Well, the documentation does exist, and there is quite a bit, and, you know, standard operating procedures. In fact, many of them are still available out there on the internet, and you know, they vary. There's you know, separate standard operating procedures for Bagram, you know, for Guantanamo, for, you know, for Iraq. So and they have changed over the years. There's also standard operating procedures for, you know, for dealing with detainees when they get out of line, when it you know, comes to eating. There's quite a bit of documentation,
mm-hmm.
And in terms of medical exams, you know, I was one particular, you know, detainee who I've spoken with, you know, said that they would one of the first things that happened, they were, you know, pricked and prodded with you know, with needles, and you know, told to you know, take certain medication. And, you know, the detainees' accounts, I have to say, to me appear genuine. And it certainly does fit, you know, the story matches, you know, others that I've, you know, that I've heard. So.
And Jason, I know you're not finished with this investigation, so can I just add another question to your list?
Yes.
Because I'm very curious, we've repeatedly seen descriptions and depictions of the process by which they would treat these detainees as they airlifted them out of Afghanistan or Iraq and into Guantanamo. And the procedure involves shackling, hooding. The people are in essentially a straitjacket with a hood. Ear muffs or, you know, headphones to block out sound, and also they were hooded, so they're effectively blindfolded. But the one thing that they always talk about is that they would cut off their old clothes, they would insert an anal suppository into the individual, and then put a diaper on them.
Right.
And now I can understand on a 12-hour flight, if you're not going to unshackle somebody, bodily functions will occur. But if you have plugged the person's rear end with a suppository and then you diaper them, that suggests to me that the suppository has drugs, and that it's intended to deliver them in a very powerful way to the center of the body instead of to the head. And so I'm very curious as to whether any mind-altering substances, from LSD to an overdose of mefloquine, might have been included in these anal suppositories that apparently were part of every routine of every rendition and every airlift transfer of a detainee in custody.
Yeah, very good questions. And I certainly will pursue those. And, you know, I can also tell you, Peter, that these acts that were conducted as the detainees were being brought to Guantanamo, you also have to look at the, you know, the psychological impact that that resulted. They were truly trying to and succeeding in breaking down mentally these detainees, and that's a very, very, very important part of the entire program itself. It's a, you know, it's all about control.
Mm-hmm.
Jeff and I will have a story coming up in a few weeks, getting into that as we've obtained some really explosive documents about the whole SEER program.
Mm-hmm.
So. We'll explore that aspect of it in our next piece.
Very good. Jason Leopold, thanks for joining me again today, and I appreciate the work you're doing. We'll link to your story in the show file at peterbcollins.com.
Pleasure, Peter. Thanks so much for having me.
And thanks for listening to this episode of the Peter B. Collins Show. You can send me an email, and I hope you will, peter@peterbcollins.com.
Happy trails to until we meet again, happy trails.